Browns training camp rolling along. Got some Gardos on the way, too. Some deadline talk. But training camp rolling along down in the Greenbrier. And it is our esteemed pleasure to welcome on one of the long-standing members, the longest-standing member of the Cleveland Browns right now. And so we're going to go out to the North Olmsted Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline and welcome in Joel Bitonio. Joel, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's great to have you, man. What, first off, how are we feeling?
Good. You know, I think off season you always feel the best. You know, that's the best I'm probably going to feel all year is the first couple of days of camp. But good. You know, we're in the Greenbrier, beautiful scenery out here. Got a few practices in, and we're making some good progress.
So, in terms of your preparation, obviously you pick things up along the way. You've worked. I mean, you've played with so many great veterans. You know, when you were a younger guy, now you're kind of the big dog in that locker room. Has how you prepare for camp and how you prepare for the season, has that changed any from when you first came to the league in 2014?
Yeah, significantly. I think when I was a rookie, I was like so nervous for every practice, every rep, just because you didn't know really what to expect. And so I would come in, and every practice was like a game for me. You know, I had to prove myself and do those things. And as I gotten older and older, you know, year 11 now, I'm like, all right, how do I get to week one? And so there's times where I have to go hard because I have to get physically ready, but there's other times where I'd be a little more mental because, you know, I have to be able to play hopefully 17-plus games this year.
So you've officially reached a point where I think Joe Thomas, your longtime offensive line mate, reached about year 7 or 8 in his career where Browns fans quietly whisper every offseason, please, God, don't let Joel Bitonio retire. We love him. We trust him. He is one of us. How much thought have you given to your future in the NFL?
I mean, you reevaluate it every year. You see how your body's feeling. It's hard because, yeah, I wish I had a crystal ball that I could look at, you know, 20 years down the line and be like, how am I feeling then? But I love playing right now. I love being with the guys. I love competing. I think we have a great team and a good chance to win this year. So it's really a no-brainer coming back this year. But I think when you get to this point, it's really a year-by-year thing, you know. How do you feel after the year? How's your family doing? Things of that nature. So obviously it's crossed my mind a little bit, but I don't think it's been a real thought, you know, the last couple of years.
Do you ever involve, like, do you ever call up Joe and just say, how did you know it was time? Or is it more just you and, you know, maybe the family decision?
Well, mostly the family, but me, at Joe's Hall of Fame thing, it was me, Joe Thomas, and Alex Mack after the, after he got announced, you know, that he was going in. We were sitting around, drinking a few pops and talking a little bit, and I was asking him because Alex Mack had played 13 years and Joe had played 11, and I was kind of seeing where their minds were at. And Alex was like, once it got harder for me, like, he's like, it was so tough for me to get to the games that, you know, there was so much preparation for my body that I just knew that I couldn't keep doing this. You know, he's like, I love playing. I wanted to keep going, but just that work to get your body ready to feel close to 100% was almost too much.
Joel Bitonio on the North Olmsted Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline live from Browns practice in West Virginia. So last year, I know it didn't end the way everybody wanted to. I know it didn't end the way you wanted to, but what a magical season, man. I mean, if you had told anybody going to that, you're going to play 5 different quarterbacks, I believe the exact number of injuries in total was just about 1,000. I know I might be rounding up a little bit. So, the one thing that we have yet to see for the Browns with this Kevin Stefanski era, the Andrew Berry era, is putting them back-to-back. So how do you double up? How do we get from a great season this last year to make it another great season this year?
Yeah, you focus on the process. You know, we start day one of camp, and it's a new season. So we're truly focused on getting through one day at a time and really just trying to improve and be the best version of ourselves. We know if we play our best football, we're going to have a chance in every single game this year. And that's really what we want to do. We want to play up to our potential as a team and try and stack some successful seasons.
So what I think is so cool about, and it's not just you, we have so many cool football stories from the mid-teens with the Browns, even though there weren't a lot of wins and losses on the field. And if you kind of look at how that happens, usually even good football players can fall through the cracks and their careers can be altered. And now we're at a point where two of the last 4 years, you're in the playoffs. We've got the first playoff win, back in 2020 since, I want to say, 2004. And Kevin Stefanski, Andrew Berry get contract extensions. At what point did you know? Because it felt like every 2 years, every year in the first 6 years of your career was a new coach or a new regime. At what point did you know that Kevin and Andrew were here to stay and that finally there was kind of the stability where good players could just focus on playing football?
Yeah, I mean, after talking with them, they're smart, intelligent, football-minded guys. But you never know how it's truly going to work out until you start playing games. But I thought the way they both handled that COVID year, it could have easily been such a roller coaster with everything that was going on and all the things that affected us. But they were so smooth and just so flatlined the whole time of hey, this is what we do. This is the standard. No matter what's happening on the outside, no matter who can play and who can't play, like, this is the group we're rolling out with. And it just brought this confidence to the team. So since then, I really have had faith in what they've done. And obviously, we've seen it with the players we've brought in and, the two playoff appearances. And hopefully, we continue to build on that. But it's been great. I know Joe, at the end of his career, it was tough for him because we were in such a rebuild that, for me, it's like, hey, we got a chance to win some games. Like, I want to be around for the winning. I went through enough losing early in my career.
What would it mean to you to play your whole career with the Cleveland Browns?
Oh, it's special. You see it, you think, when I'm a kid, I was watching Aaron Rodgers play, and you're like, oh, he's a Green Bay Packer for life, and now he's been on another team, and you see these guys that you think are iconic players for franchises, and it never works out. Not never, but it's very rare that it works out. Von Miller, Emmitt Smith towards the end of his career, you see these guys that are, like, going to other teams, and they're the bulk of their career is the one team, but I think it's special that if I could do that, if I could finish my career here and, be a Brown for life.
Joel, Kevin Stefanski made some big news yesterday when he announced he was keeping play calling duties. And that it's been very nice for sports talk. So I really appreciate it. Just pass that on to Kevin. We appreciate when he does stuff like that because we have content. But I'm curious, does it matter to you guys up front who calls the plays?
Not really. We never hear it. It's going into Deshaun's ear and he relays the message to us. I know they're going to be very, they're going to work together a lot. We have a lot of guys from different systems. They're going to come together with a great game plan. And Coach Stefanski said it by the end of the day, like, we're so prepared by game day that a lot of times he's just pointing out the sheet, like, all right, it's third down, like, what's worked and what's next on the play sheet. So, it's definitely a group effort, but for us players, we're just focused. We I didn't know what was going on. We didn't know as much as I saw it online yesterday. So it's good. I think it's out of the way, and now we can just, focus on playing ball.
So the big piece of change, and this is good news. We're talking about position coach changes, but Bill Callahan, after 4 years, moves down to Tennessee with his son, Brian, Andy Dickerson, and Roy Eastvan in as the new offensive line coaches. What are your first impressions of the new O-line coaches here?
Yeah, it's great energy. They both come from different places. Like, Coach Roy was in Philly, and he has a lot of that RPO system, the stuff they do with Hurts and Brown and their receivers over there. So that's been awesome to have that knowledge. And then Coach Dickerson, I've actually had a little bit of experience with him coming out of the draft, so I knew of him, and we had talked. He brings a great energy. He brings a great knowledge. He's had some of that outside zone, mid-zone experience, kind of stuff that Kevin likes to call. And so it's a great mix, honestly, for us. They've meshed well, we've meshed well, and there's really good energy in the line room right now.
So what's the biggest change we should expect up front in terms of what you guys are going to be doing versus maybe what you've done the last 4 years?
I don't know if there's too much, I mean, it's gonna depend on the plays we call, Obviously, like, if we're not running – I mean, we were so versatile the last few years. Like, we had gap, we had zone, we had inside zone, we had pin and pull. We still have all that in our playbook, so it's really going to come down to what plays. But Coach Dickerson, he's a very good coach, but he's like, what do you do well as a player? Like, let's do that, And so you're going to see guys that if me and White are a little bit different, the way we pass block or do things, like, it might show up a little differently, but the goal is to get the job done.
Joel Bitonio, Browns guard on the North Olmsted Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline, live from West Virginia, as practice has just wrapped up here. So Obviously, this is the time of year we tell stories about bygone camps and camps from early in your career. Do you have any favorite camp stories that you can remember you can share with us right now?
I feel like early in my career, it was one of the Pettine years, so it could have been my first or second year. We were practicing, and it was getting a little bit, even back then, it was a little more physical. You were in full pads every day. Like, there was full contact periods and stuff. So we were going, and there had been probably like three or four fights that day, and the defense had really initiated all the fights, you know what I mean? And finally, we were in the huddle, and Joe Thomas was like, hey, if that MFer does that again, like, we're going after him. One of the D linemen was, you know, being dumb. And so he did. And, you know, the whole line stood up for, I think it was Mitch Schwartz at the time, the right tackle. And we went after him. And of course, the fourth fight of the day or whatever that the offense, you know, officially started, we had to run half gassers for. But it's one of those stories where, you know, you have a defensive coach, defense gets a little more leeway. You have an offensive coach, offense gets a little more leeway. But that one kind of sticks out as an early memory in camp.
I believe I remember that. That was the rare day that I was there. And it was, I don't remember from there because I've heard the story so many times, and I remember Joe telling it as well. And there's nothing like a good O-line, D-line fighting camp. So this year, one of the things I really get excited about is when you start to see kind of young depth, and like you can start to see where the O-line's going to go once you decide to hang up your spikes. When Wyatt and Jack Conklin and all these guys who right now they're the face, you can see where this thing could go. And so you got Zach Zinter, a third round pick out of Michigan. You've got the kid on the international practice spot as well. So you have all these young players. You got the Ohio State center. I'm just curious, like, what is your message to those young guys who not only are they looking to be in the NFL, but might want to take your job too?
Oh yeah. I mean, we don't think about that kind of stuff. Like it's a group right now. I think we have 18 guys in the room, and we're just trying to, our goal is to be one of the best O-lines in the league. And so we need everybody to achieve that goal. Guys get banged up, in season. So we're working on that right now. But I tell them, ask questions like, let's learn, let's work, anything you guys need. And I think for them, the preseason's awesome because they get so many more reps. If I have an off day or something like that, they can jump in and get some reps. And preseason games are, nothing's like a game. So get out there, get as many reps as you can. But we're trying to be the best unit we can be. So that's really the message. It's like, hey, your best individual self is going to help us be the best unit. So let's get everybody to be the best they can be.
Joel, the most visually shocking thing I think I saw last year in camp was Wyatt Teller, who is by no means a small man, standing next to Juwan Jones, who is a very large man. And this is probably one of my favorite questions to ask you, offensive lineman. Is Juwan Jones the biggest football player you've ever seen in the NFL?
Gosh, I think so. I mean, there's been a couple other tackles that are huge men too, but I think Juwan just like overall is probably the biggest.
I would not want to try. I saw him hand fight with Nick Bosa and win last year, and I was like, all right, I've seen enough. Joel, you're always so gracious with your time, man. You're always so good on this, you know, with this kind of stuff. It's no doubt in anybody's mind that whenever you do decide to hang up, you're going to have a great career in media if you want it. So just congrats. Thank you. Cannot wait to see you out there this year, and best of luck in camp, man.
Appreciate you having me. Thanks.
Joel Batonio, Browns guard on the North Olmsted Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram hotline. Browns guard Joel Batonio talking retirement thoughts of retirement as he heads into yet another season here with the Cleveland Browns and what it would mean to finish his entire career as a Cleveland Brown. And I'll be honest with you, even as soon as like 2 or 3 years ago, I probably wasn't that, I don't want to say enamored, but I it wasn't that much of a must have, because it's so rare that guys spend their entire career in one spot. But the more, I don't know, just it's just the longer he's been here, if he plays another year or two here and like spends 1 year in Miami, they've had enough dudes like that. Like, it has become important to me that Joel spends his entire career here. And so I thought, and the retirement stuff's really interesting because, you know, we've had this conversation with Nick Chubb because of his injuries and because of paying running backs. You know, last year it was, are you going into this year maybe watching Nick Chubb as if it could be his last year in Cleveland? And ironically, the injury pretty much solidified the fact he was going to be here, because it kind of took the contractual conversation out of both he and the Browns' hands, because he's coming off an injury and that became the focal point. But don't know what I just said there. By the way, we do have Daryl Ryder coming up in about 40 minutes. But I kind of am going into this season less about him playing elsewhere and more about retirement. I'm kind of going into this one watching Joel with a serious mindset of, this might be his last year. Because I don't know if you guys know, guards don't do big retirement tours. Well, they don't get those. Kind of like, Joe Thomas didn't get a big retirement tour. Joe kind of discreetly retired. And we kind of knew it could happen, but we didn't know it was officially going to happen. I kind of feel the same way with Joel. We're going to be keenly aware that at any point, any season, he can retire. And then one year, it's just going to happen. So I'm going into now, and I probably will for the rest of his career, with that mindset. Really great stuff with Joel, by the way. I will have more of that coming up in the 5 at 5 to react to. But as we were wrapping up the conversation with Joe Bitonio, we got some pretty interesting news here. And there are, as most wide receivers have gotten paid here over this last summer, there's still some quarterbacks out there that there are some contracts that are being wrapped up. One is Jordan Love. That has not been announced yet, but he has not been at camp. That is a big to-do. I don't know Brock Purdy's going to get paid before this year, or before the end of the season, but that's another kind of big domino to fall out there that will in some way set the market. I don't expect Brock Purdy to set the top end of the market, but I think we're starting to see that, like, you get paid within specific tiers, which makes this news very interesting, as multiple reports now say Tua Tagovailoa is signing a 4-year, $212 million extension to keep him with Miami beyond the season. Tua will be the highest paid quarterback, the third highest paid quarterback in the NFL this season on a per year basis. I will say, it's been very fun to watch agents who spent 5 or 6 years tell us the only thing that mattered in any of these deals is guaranteed money. Now that the NFL has pretty much explicitly said there's not a shot in hell we're giving another quarterback a fully guaranteed contract, it's pretty interesting to see that now we've shifted the goalpost to the average salary per year. But I'll just say this. What the hell was Miami supposed to do? And, like, this is the reality. Like, the Browns faced this decision not too far ago, right? Or far too long ago. They went into, coming off the 2021 season, saying, we're probably at the point where we either need to pay Baker Mayfield, coming off an injury, coming off all the drama of 2021, or we need to try and take a swing to do better than him. And I think if you look at that draft, there were some interesting names, but maybe not somebody you were going to trade up, and maybe the first pick wasn't available that year. So, okay, that's off the table. What veterans are there out there? Well, Deshaun Watson was the only one. The Browns made that trade, traded Baker to Carolina, and the last 2 years is history. I don't think Tua is the third best quarterback in the NFL. I think if we were going back to the Jared Goff Mendoza line, like I did on the Infinity Sports Network this last Sunday, or like we kind of did earlier this week on the show, I would have Tua behind Jared Goff. I don't know I'd even have Tua in the top 13 or 14. I think Tua is very much like Brock Purdy. I think he is a fine quarterback. I think he is very much a his numbers, I should say, are very much a product of the system he plays in. And so, do I look at the Dolphins paying Tua $53 million a year for the next 4 years? Do I look at that as the smartest investment? No, I think at some point they're going to run into the same problem that once upon a time the Rams did with Jared Goff, that I think the 49ers eventually ran into with his injury problems too with Jimmy Garoppolo. We're going to look at that quarterback and go, this guy's only going to take us so far. At the same point, it's easier to say teams should move on from these quarterbacks than it actually is to pull off. And like, for instance, and even to this day, you can defend the ideology in which the Browns used to go from Baker Mayfield to Deshaun Watson. Was it probably sloppier than it needed to be? Yeah, but Baker's an emotional guy. Baker probably owns part of that, right? But in fairness, the Browns, whomever, whether it was Baker's agent, somebody in the Browns organization, however the quote got out there that the Browns needed an adult in the room, and that was their justification for moving on from Baker and pursuing Deshaun, you can see how Baker took that personally, given what Baker had meant to this organization and given what Deshaun was being accused of and eventually suspended for and sued for. That was unnecessarily sloppy. But the logic is pretty sound. You've got a quarterback that you feel like is capped by talent or whatever, and there's a quarterback out there that has already been established as a top five, top 10 quarterback in the NFL. It has not worked out that well. Not to this point. Now, in fairness, it didn't work out for Baker the first couple years, but certainly last year it did. I think that is, I actually think a fair amount of teams around the NFL look at the Cleveland Browns, look at that situation and go, the Browns moved on from Baker because they wanted a quarterback that they could win a Super Bowl with, and 2 years later, they're no closer to winning a Super Bowl. And I know that the circumstances around Deshaun are incredibly rare. Dudes don't get paid. Dudes don't request a trade, then immediately get accused of sexual harassment, sexual assault, then get paid to be on the active roster but not play for a full season, then get traded in the offseason, only to then be suspended by the league for 6 games, which turned into 11 games, then play 6 games, come back the next year, play again, get hurt a bunch, and in 2 years' time, only play 11 games. Well, too many people have started using the phrase unprecedented times with things that are very precedented in this country. Like, we do have, and it is something about the human mind that now either has to be the absolute best or the absolute worst of circumstances ever in history, even though it is not even remotely close to the truth. The Deshaun thing is wildly unprecedented in the NFL. But I think it illustrates the truth that teams have to know. I guarantee you there's people in the Miami organization that think the same way about Tua Tagovailoa getting $53.1 million that the average Twitter user, who I'm seeing in all these mentions making fun of this contract, think. But there's something to be said about, we don't have a path to get better at quarterback right now. Tua has finally started to pay dividends under the Mike McDaniel system, so why don't we pay him and see if maybe we're wrong? Why don't we pay him and see if we catch the year where you can win with a quarterback who probably isn't responsible for you winning a Super Bowl? And I think more teams should think like this. Like, the Jared Goff deal got panned, and Jared is now the fourth highest paid quarterback on a per year basis going forward. It's like, what is Detroit's option? Like, there were people in Detroit who said, don't pay Jared Goff 3 months after he had them in the NFC title game. And that would be fine if you had, like, the Packers moved on from Aaron Rodgers because they had Jordan Love sitting behind him. We were all pretty skeptical about it when it happened. This last year, especially in the down the stretch, Jordan Love looked like a franchise quarterback up until probably the second half of that 49ers second round playoff game. So I don't know why more teams aren't comfortable. Now, in this case, you're paying Jared Goff top five money. In this case, you're paying that same quarterback top three money in Tua Tagovailoa. But I would rather pay, and maybe overpay in the parlance of some, for the 13th best quarterback in the NFL. I'd rather overpay Kirk Cousins 10 times out of 10 than go into an offseason where essentially the Steelers have lived this last year, which is the quarterbackless abyss. Because usually when teams enter that, it's ego. Like Matt Rhule took over in Carolina, and they were going to move on from Cam because Cam was coming off a shoulder injury. And they're like, we're going to get Teddy Bridgewater. And then they sucked that first year, and because Teddy wasn't anything more than Teddy Bridgewater had been, they're like, we gotta do better than this. And so they traded a 2, a 4, and a second for Sam Darnold. And then Sam Darnold sucked because, quite frankly, Sam Darnold sucks. And they're like, oh, well, this won't stand, but we still got to pay Sam, so we can't afford another quarterback. 2 years or a year after cutting Teddy Bridgewater and trading for Sam Darnold, so we're going to trade like a 4th-round pick for Baker Mayfield. Or a 5th-round pick for Baker Mayfield. And then, lo and behold, it didn't work. Why? Hubris. Coaches think that they can do better than the perfectly fine quarterback that they have. And every coach feels like they can... I've heard Ron Rivera say it himself in Washington. We're going to quarterback-proof. We're going to build a roster that doesn't rely on a franchise quarterback. No. You're going to build a roster that gets your ass fired in 3 years. Am I comfortable paying Tua Tagovailoa top three money? No, nobody is. Nobody in that Miami organization today is like, we got him. We kept him. There has to be an admission that you're just churning water here. You're just treading water until either that option becomes available. And by the way, why don't teams just draft developmental quarterbacks and try and figure that? Anyway, I digress. That's what San Francisco did. They drafted 2 developmental quarterbacks when they knew in the future they were going to move on from Jimmy Garoppolo. One of them worked out. It just wasn't the guy they took with the 3rd pick. 216-474-0092. So Tua Tagovailoa getting a 4-year, $212.4 million contract extension by the Miami Marlins.
Or Dolphins.
Them two. It actually would be something if the Marlins spent that kind of money. That leads me to my next point. Spend more money. Bruce Sherman. I think he's still the owner of the team. But no. $212.4 million by the Miami Dolphins. I don't know anybody thinks this is a great idea. But I think treating this like it's a god-awful idea when teams that try to either go in a different direction that isn't definitively better, and even when teams try to go in a direction that everybody agrees, hey, anybody in the world in 2021 heading into 2022 would have changed out Baker Mayfield for Deshaun Watson. That was supposed to be a can't-miss move. 2 years later, we're still waiting for it to not miss. Guardians have the series with the Phillies starting tonight, and in pretty much every one of these games, the Phillies have the pitching advantage. And that's not really something we're used to. Or sorry, that's not something new to us this year as you went into Detroit. Half those games thinking Detroit had the pitching advantage. But we didn't get to this yesterday because obviously we had a bunch of press conferences. And, you know, Chris Antonetti spoke to the media yesterday. And he talked about the Guardians, and I've already seen like Jeff Passan say stuff about it's going to be tough to make a trade. Here was Chris Antonetti on where this team is in trade talks.
I would say we're actively engaged, exploring opportunities to try to improve the team. It's hard to predict what will come of that. I think it is important to remember, and I think I've shared this with you before, no matter what happens at the trade deadline, it's important to remember that the group of guys in that clubhouse are the ones that have played and put us in the position to win the amount of games that we have. And our success in the second half is going to continue to be determined by that group of guys. And again, if we can find opportunities to complement it, great. But I think it's important to remember that, you know, again, the success of our season will be dependent upon the way that group of players continues to play and perform and the way we support them to help them do that.
So I'm just going to say this, and this is probably about 50% for the front office. This is about 50% for the media that carries water for these teams. And I'm not going to hammer the Guardians until they don't make a move. But this is my word of caution to a team that has somehow hit almost every button right this year. From you've got weather, which you can't control. The weather has been as good as I remember it being in Cleveland during summer. Very little rain. A lot of really nice days, even if it was still a little chilly, nice days early in the season. From the actual what they controlled, they kind of started out with a red-hot team for the first 75 games of the season. I think that shows that you also hired the right manager. So even any of the smaller moves, like Ben Lively, has paid immense dividends for a move we really didn't talk about at all. A guy that I don't think we were shocked that he made the starting rotation, but we certainly didn't expect this guy to be anything more than a fifth starter. And at points, he's been much more than that. He's kind of settled into just being kind of a back end of the rotation guy, but that's who he's been in his career. You're still getting some of the better performances week in, week out from a guy we started the season thinking he might not last the full season as a fifth starter. So that the product at the actual stadium, meaning the changes they made to the stadium, have been a rousing success. City Connect has been an insanely big success. So, hell, the other day, we found out that teams suffering from the regional sports network money blues are going to get an extra $15 million in money going forward because of that. So they're going to get additional revenue sharing. You couldn't draw up the first 102 games as well as it is gone. I also am not dumb enough to act as if they're probably not. They're probably acting as if they're not swimming upstream to some degree when it comes to pay front off. You know what is ownership really going to allow? And I understand that Chris Antonetti is just couching almost everything he says, because that's what Chris does. And that's what Chernoff does. That's what Vogt does. Baseball's a very, very conservative sport when it comes to saying anything of value anymore. And that's because of the influx of Ivy Leaguers over the last 30 years. You don't get credit for trying, though. And so, like Randy Arozarena was traded last night, a guy that I thought would have been perfect for the Guardians because it's corner power in the outfield. And Arozarena is also a guy who, when you get to October, just seems to be an even better player than he is in the regular season. He's not really hitting right now, but look at the price for him. The Rays got two very nice, very young prospects. I think both guys are like 20 years old. I would be surprised if either guy doesn't shoot up the board, given that they're both very young and both very productive, and a player to be named later. So they got two very nice prospects who are probably going to age into even better prospects, even if they don't become good major leaguers, and yet a third prospect we don't know about yet. For a guy who's hitting, like, I think he's got like a 626 OPS this year, Randy Arozarena does. I have no doubt that the price out there right now is exorbitant. I have no doubt that if you want to get a frontline starting pitcher, you're going to have to pay out the ass for it. I have no doubt that if you just want a good, like we're talking about a 5 or 6 hitter, this year's Teoscar Hernandez, which I think Randy Arozarena is slightly better than that, but that's, you know, Garcia from Texas, if he's available. It's going to cost you. Yes, no bleep it's going to cost you. But you don't get credit for trying. And at the end of October, as we saw in 2016, and that they did try that year, They can't help it. Luke Croy said he didn't want to be here. They probably should have known Brandon Guyer and Coco Crisp weren't going to be the end-all be-all, but at least they tried. They did trade for Andrew Miller. You don't get credit for trying. And you don't have to make three moves, which each one of those moves is going to be somebody that moves the needle in October. You might just need one or two guys that kind of get you to October. I'm totally understanding of that. But this better not have been setting us up, getting us ready for your inability to do your job. The locker room has done theirs. They have vastly outproduced every single thing we have asked or expected of them going into this year. The fans have vastly, vastly outproduced what we thought they were going to do. We've gone full Costner. If you build it, they will come. They have come. Now it is on Antonetti and Chernoff. So my word of warning with, 5 days to go, I don't give a rat's ass how expensive it is. I'm talking about collateral for the draft, or for prospects. I don't care if, gosh darn it, you really got to roll up your sleeves and get something done. Do it. Because if you don't, it will be the biggest false note in a season up to now of ridiculous success. And unfortunately, they're going to stop coming to the park. Unfortunately, I don't know the locker room's going to respond if you don't back them up. I really hope what we heard yesterday was just the traditional play it down because that's what we do because we went to Ivy League and we're all a bunch of corporate dudes and, you know, we take the emotion out of sports, which is quite frankly the best part of sports. I hope that's what it was. If it's getting us ready for you to do nothing, honestly, it'll be the biggest failure of these two guys' career in Cleveland and the rare massive failure.